25 miles at a 15-mile-an-hour pace, road, gravel, mountain bikes, welcome to. The first ride is...
This is KGNU-FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. Stay tuned for Metro.
Support comes from WellMind Connection, a non-emergency navigator program that connects you with local resources. Their bilingual team is trained to connect community members with mental health and other supportive resources to fit a wide range of needs. More information can be found by emailing wellmind@bouldercounty.org.
Join KGNU for our 37th annual Charles Sawtelle Memorial Mountain Jam, Sunday, July 20th, noon to 5 p.m., in the side yard of the Gold Hill Inn. Enjoy the fresh mountain air of an outdoor setting with acoustic roots music by Foggy Mountain Spaceship, the Todd Livingston Unit, and headliners Rebecca Fraser with Becky Buller. Barbecue and cold beverages for purchase. Bring quilts and low-slung lawn chairs for relaxing, family-friendly vibes to benefit your community radio station. Tickets and info at kgnu.org.
Hello, I'm Tony Tresca. Welcome to the very first episode of the Bucket List Community Cafe radio show on KGNU. We're bringing you hyper-local stories from the heart of Denver, covering everything from street safety and neighborhood events to arts and culture and the unexpected moments that make this city feel like home. Coming up on today's show, we'll explore why Federal Boulevard is one of the most dangerous streets in Denver, why there's no bus service to Red Rocks, the Cherry Creek Arts Festival, and we'll give one former fan's take on the Rockies. Before we dive in, a quick note about who we are. Bucket List is a newsroom powered by emerging journalists, many of whom are reporting on the places that they grew up in. I serve as our editor, and I'm passionate about making local news more accessible, more human, and more relevant to everyone. For a little bit more on the name, as well as how all this got started, here's our publisher, Vicki Collins.
Hi, everyone. First of all, there is no cafe, at least not in the brick-and-mortar sense of the word. Bucket List Community Cafe is online community journalism. We're free, hyper-local neighborly news that serves the Denver area with a solution-oriented focus. Plus, we mentor the next generation of journalists with internships and paid apprenticeships. Our mission is to make everyone feel represented. Here's the story about the name. I've spent my entire career as a television producer for both local and network TV. When I envisioned a future outside of broadcasting, I saw myself running a coffee shop with an art gallery and bookstore. But there are a lot of coffee shops out there. So in August 2019, I started an online blog and named it Bucket List Community Cafe because it was on my bucket list to have a place of community connection. During COVID, Bucket List helped the Denver area navigate the challenges of the pandemic, and we found our purpose: to bring you trustworthy news and build community by sharing our stories. Since then, we've also mentored almost 75 aspiring journalists from three universities, CU Boulder, MSU Denver, and DU, and they're moving forward to great jobs. We have a unique niche at the intersection of journalism, community, and education, and we are 100% community supported. No paywalls, paid memberships, paid subscriptions, or ad clutter. Free and accessible to all. Bucket List Community Cafe believes news can connect rather than divide us. Thanks for joining us on our first program on KGNU, and thanks to Dave Ashton, who is teaching our team radio. We want to hear your ideas and feedback, so please visit us online at bucketlistcommunitycafe.com. You can subscribe to our free newsletters and contribute to keep this work going. Tune in the first Thursday of every month from 3 to 3:30 for more information, inspiration, interaction, and impact.
Thanks, Vicki. Now, let's talk street safety. Federal Boulevard is one of the busiest streets in Denver and one of the deadliest. Since the start of the year, four people have died along its stretch. Federal Boulevard is the kind of street that makes even the most experienced commuters nervous. As one high school student told our reporter Cassis Tingley, it kind of freaks me out. So what makes this corridor so dangerous? A lot of it comes down to speed. The speed limit is 35, but the design of the road, which features wide lanes, open ramps, and low pedestrian protection, encourages people to drive much faster. Efforts like the city's speed program are a start, but they've been criticized for not going far enough. City Councilwoman Jamie Torres and safety advocates like Alan Cowgill say we need more than signs and signal changes. We need real infrastructure, narrower lanes, protected crossings, even speed bumps, especially in communities of color along Colfax, where investment has historically lagged. As Cowgill put it, at the end of the day, we have to decide, do we want to move cars quickly or save lives? That question is especially urgent when kids are getting hurt just trying to get to school. Recently, there have been multiple crashes involving young people walking or biking in Northwest Denver. We asked transportation advocate Matthew Elliott what needs to change.
The recent crashes involving middle school students in Northwest Denver are devastating, and they highlight a systemic failure to protect the most vulnerable people on our streets. A student on a bike was hit at 41st and Lowell, an intersection that already has a flashing beacon, which clearly isn't enough. Another was hit on 41st, legally crossing Federal with a signal. A third child was killed while trying to cross Federal at 52nd. Most recently, another was hit on the Perry Street bikeway at 45th. These are not isolated incidents. They're part of a repeated pattern on streets we already know are dangerous. Federal Boulevard in particular is on Denver's high injury network. And yet we continue to allow high speeds, wide lanes, and turning conflicts in areas where kids are trying to get to school, the park, their friend's house. The city's response is temporary grief and long-term inaction. Denver has claimed to adopt Vision Zero, but the reality is there's been no meaningful follow-through. When a serious crash happens, even in the same location like 14th and Federal, directly in front of CDOT headquarters, nothing changes. There's no redesign, no protected infrastructure, no shift in policy. We simply hope it doesn't happen again until inevitably it does. That's not Vision Zero, that's negligence. To truly prevent these tragedies, we need to stop relying on enforcement and education alone and start building infrastructure that requires safe behavior. Right now, a driver might get a ticket for speeding or failing to yield. That's punishment, arbitrary and inconsistent. But if a street is designed so that speeding or dangerous turns are physically difficult or impossible, that's consequence, reliable and automatic. That's how you change behavior. And we need leadership, from the mayor's office to Dottie and CDOT, that treats safe mobility as a fundamental right, not a perk for people in cars. The goal shouldn't be moving cars quickly through our neighborhoods. It should be moving people safely, however they can or choose to get around.
Elliot bikes his kids to school every day and says the system isn't broken. It's working exactly how it was built. For cars, not people. He says the only way to make the streets safer is to redesign them so dangerous behavior isn't just discouraged, it's physically difficult. Here's what type of infrastructure Elliot argues is missing in Denver.
Dottie's complete streets guidelines lay out a clear hierarchy of concerns. Pedestrians first, then people on bikes and other micromobility devices, transit users, freight and goods movement, and finally private vehicles. On paper, that hierarchy sounds like the right approach, but in practice it's never actually followed. Project after project continues to prioritize car throughput and convenience over the safety and comfort of those walking, biking, or rolling. If Dottie were truly designing streets for the most vulnerable users first, we'd see infrastructure that reflects that. Raised crosswalks, concrete-protected bike lanes, narrowed travel lanes, and traffic-calming designs that slow vehicles down by default. Instead, we still see wide, fast streets with paint and maybe plastic bike lanes, if any, and crosswalks that force people on foot to descend into car space like second-class citizens. Raised crosswalks are a great example of the kind of infrastructure that would align with the city's stated priorities. Instead of making pedestrians dip down into the roadway and rely on drivers to yield, raised crosswalks maintain a continuous path at sidewalk level. This not only reinforces that pedestrians have the right of way, it physically forces cars to slow down as they move over the crossing. It's a simple and proven tool used in cities around the world, yet you'll be hard-pressed to find any in Denver, even near schools or along corridors where serious crashes continue to happen. If Dottie really believed that pedestrian safety comes first, raised crosswalks would be standard, not rare. Another persistent problem is the expectation that everyone, people walking, biking, driving, even scootering, should all share the same space, often with little or no separation. This kind of mixed-use design might sound inclusive, but in practice it's confusing, stressful, and dangerous. The safest and most effective infrastructure provides separated, purpose-built space for each mode of travel. Pedestrians need sidewalks and safe crossings. People on bikes or scooters need physically protected lanes, not paint buffers, that are consistent and predictable. And cars need to be kept out of those spaces, with physical boundaries and traffic calming features to reduce speed and conflict. When you blend all modes into the same narrow corridor, it guarantees conflict and puts the burden of safety on the least protected users. Ultimately, we can't rely on individual behavior to fix a systemic design failure. Most drivers are doing what they think is right. They're staying in their lane, driving near the speed limit, turning when they have a green light, but the infrastructure itself gives them permission to behave in ways that feel normal, yet put others at risk. If the cues you get from the road, wide lanes, long signal cycles, minimal pedestrian infrastructure, tell you to keep moving fast and pay little attention to those outside your car, then even your best intentions won't keep others safe. We need to build streets that require safe behavior, not just signs that suggest it. That means real infrastructure changes, not just symbolic policies or Vision Zero statements with no teeth.
And Elliot isn't just talking about what's wrong. He's been a part of community discussions around the Bus Rapid Transit project on Federal. Unfortunately, their vision for a safer street hasn't made it into CDOT's current designs. Now, not every transportation story in Denver is about danger, but a lot of them are about frustration, especially when it comes to getting to one of our most iconic venues, Red Rocks. Our PJ Guidry has more on that. I'll start our conversation off with the title of a recent article that you wrote for us. Why is it so hard to get to Red Rocks?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to pay to get there. That's the gist of it. But you're either dealing with the pricing or you're dealing with the hiking. But the time that you choose is really going to be dependent on what you want to pay.
And now, Red Rocks is not some small-scale venue. It has a massive economic contribution. So why aren't there more routes to this venue?
Yeah, it is crazy because they're competing with Madison Square Garden as far as attendance numbers. There are 2 million people that went there over last year, and that's within just 6-7 months of proving themselves. But I think that if you don't want to take the shuttle, you don't want to take an Uber or a Lyft, then you're going to have to drive yourself.
So right now people either have to drive, get a ride share, or pay for that private shuttle because there's no RTD line available.
Yeah, there's no public transportation. They have a grant that they're going to try to hand out, but again, that's hypothetical. It's called the RTD System Optimization Plan. And I think that that grant, even though if it comes in August, would still be, again, just like the rapid transit, it would be years of construction trying to get through a mountain that you're going to have to carve.
Totally. So even if that grant is approved come August to add that line to more in Morrison, it's still going to be years away from actually having reliable public transportation to Red Rocks.
Yeah, of course. I mean, they said that, I mean, to me specifically, the Arts and Venues office said that people have been going there for 84 years. They're going to continue to figure out how to get there. It's not necessarily their biggest concern.
Well, I know we'll all be watching that grant come August. So hopefully one day the road to Red Rocks won't be so rocky.
Yeah. Again, hypothetically, but yes.
Cool. Thanks for that update, PJ. While transportation challenges can leave us feeling powerless, other parts of Denver's civic life are showing signs of connection and creativity. One example? A packed screening of Join or Die at the Holiday Theater on June 12th, part of the new Denver Community Film Festival. Our Sadie Gonzalez was there and is now in the studio to discuss. What was that experience like, Sadie?
The experience was very positive. Over 40 community organizers came together with the Denver Inner Neighborhood Cooperation hosting the event. People seemed really eager and excited to participate in the first Denver Community Film Festival at the Holiday Theater. It just was a very overall connective experience for everyone involved.
Can you tell me a little bit about the film that everybody had gathered to see, Join or Die? What was that documentary about?
The documentary followed Dr. Robert Putnam, the author of Bowling Alone, and its overall premise was that joining a club can save democracy by having people come into community and connecting with each other.
Yeah, I remember reading his Bowling Alone book in my undergrad political science class, but I never thought that it would be the subject of a documentary, much less a community event that brought a bunch of Denver people out and together. What was that experience like? What was before and after the event?
Yeah, so there were tables around the lobby of the theater where different organizations were able to talk about their programming and everything. Bienvenidos Food Bank was one of those organizations, as well as Bucket List Community Cafe. Speaking of which, there was a panel after the showing where Bucket List Community Cafe's publisher, Vicki Collins, was hosting the panel and spoke with co-director Rebecca Davis. She discussed three simple steps people can take to get more engaged in their community.
I try to think this in terms of kind of like three rings that people can look at in their life. So one thing that I think everyone in the audience could hopefully do, you know, tonight or in the next 24 hours is if you are on your social media and you're sharing information, think about what you're sharing. Is it information that's far away, that's hard for your neighbors to tap into? Or are there things you can find and start sharing and start being a part of rebuilding that local information ecosystem? And not just sharing stories of doom and gloom, but also stories that are gonna, you know, inspire people, like I'm sure my co-panelists, stories of their work, so people know where to go to get involved, so we can start closing that loop of information to action. I think we're being informed to death, but we're not able to close that loop to actually get out and actually be involved. So that's one thing I hope everyone can do in the next 24 hours. In the next week, what I hope people can do is ask yourself, what are you doing in your life right now alone that you could be doing together? I think that's the other thing that happens in this information ecosystem we live in, is the problems seem so big that we can just feel helpless, you know, at home, or they're far away and we feel like we can't do anything about them. But if we start from a place of saying, what am I doing alone by myself? Is there 5-10 other people that I can bring together to start doing that work communally? You know, maybe it's walking, maybe it's cooking, maybe it's childcare. Just take a survey of your life and see. And then from there, once you have that group mobilized, you know, and maybe this is going to be the longer runway, maybe a year, 2 years from now, after you've started, you know, meeting with those neighbors, building up that social capital, you can then as a group start saying, you know, what are the needs in my community that we as a group, now that we've mobilized together and have this power in numbers, what are the needs in the community that we can start addressing? And on the longer timeline out from there, what do we want our community to look like that it doesn't look like now? And that was one thing I loved, getting to go through the history of all these, you know, amazing organizations in our country, and these amazing historic moments from, you know, racial justice fights to gender fights in this country, you know, two of which we highlighted in the film. Those all started the work of, you know, changing those issues in our country. They all started with a handful of people meeting up.
Okay.
Thanks, Sadie. For those of you who missed the film festival, you can check out the documentary Join or Die on Netflix.
No, you know what? I will be here.
If you've ever sipped Ethiopian coffee or walked past the Nile Ethiopian restaurant on Colfax, you've seen just a glimpse of the deep cultural roots of Denver's Ethiopian community. PJ spent time talking with folks about the history, contributions, and cultural footprints of Ethiopians here in Denver. PJ, what did you learn from your conversations?
Well, for one, I learned that there are nearly 50,000 Ethiopians in the Denver metro area, and it seems like 49,000 of them live in south of Aurora. But I know that for a fact. If you meet one, you're going to meet the rest of them. And it was really interesting for me to know that they have their own culture built here and built around the settings of Denver.
What is it about Denver that has attracted so many Ethiopians not only to come here, but really to make their homes here?
Yeah, I mean, there's now like 3-4 generations of Ethiopians who are now not only from Ethiopia, but from Denver. And I talked to Kabidi, Yoma Kabidi, and he told me that when he found Denver, that he found community, found home. And he said that you could look up 400, 500 Ethiopian names, call them right now, and they'll come over to help you.
So it's really that kind of community that's built here that has allowed so many Ethiopians to stay.
Yeah, it's chain migration. I know that when one family member comes, they know that they have somebody that they trust and love. And I talked to Kadus Abuhai, and he works at the Ethiopian Community Center here in Colorado. They help with jobs, food, with a place to stay that not necessarily is a transition place, but something that you can use and build your wealth while you're here.
Interesting. So it's Denver is really set up so that people can actually live here rather than just pass through here.
Yeah, many of the Ethiopians that live in Denver are now business owners or own their own homes and started their families here, and their children all go to the same schools. So it's really easy to form that community.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much, PJ, for giving us that report on the Ethiopian community here in Denver.
Yeah, of course.
Next up, we're shifting from neighborhoods to the arts. The Cherry Creek Arts Festival is just around the corner, and artist Bala Thiagarajan will be one of the many featured creatives. Our reporter, Rylan Scholes, caught up with her ahead of the festival.
You've been selected as one of 260 artists to participate in the very prestigious Cherry Creek Arts Festival in Denver from July 4th through 6th. And congratulations, by the way. You know, what does it mean for you to be able to display your art at on such a big stage?
It is so exciting to be selected to be one of the artists, especially one of 64 new artists this year at the Cherry Creek Arts Festival. It is particularly very meaningful to me because of the kind of works I create and the ethnic nature and the cultural stories that I am bringing. To have a voice in a show like Cherry Creek, like I said, it's not just about representation, right? It's about who I am engaging with actually. And the platform that Cherry Creek gives me with, you know, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, how many visitors they get, but 100,000 plus people. And even if a fraction of those people engaged with my art, that's amazing, right? They're taking back something more when they leave the show. And I'm just so thrilled to have this visibility.
How special is it to be able to blend henna and Indian culture with your art?
Not everybody gets to create their culture in some form and be able to talk about it. I know so many artists who, you know, paint abstracts, and I joke, I'd rather paint mandalas than mountains, and people tell me, please, we have enough people painting mountains in Colorado. But the idea is, you know, yes, painting mountains will sell, but those conversations and those connections that I develop by painting mandalas, Vicky, for example, being here is through my artwork. You guys noticed it because it's different, and like you said, it's distinctive, and it reminds you of something that's familiar, but it also invokes some kind of a curiosity that you want to learn more about it.
How has your South Indian heritage shaped your artistic voice beyond your visual style?
So I grew up with color culture, and you know, I come from a country with a billion people, right? So with a lot of people, especially strong women around me. And so, like you said, it's not just about creating or showing or selling my work anymore. It's also about representation, making space. How do I provide a voice for people who want to do what I do? And so that has become very important to me.
Thanks, Rylan, for facilitating that conversation with Bala. But if you're still hankering for more arts updates, Sadie is back to share some more information about some other July events, including the Underground Music Showcase. She's been tracking how UMS has been evolving over the years and is here now to share a few highlights from this year's event.
This year marks 25 years of UMS and takes place July 25th through the 27th on South Broadway. Originally, the festival started off as a list of bands based in Denver for one of the founders to find out what the music scene was like here.
Cool. So who is on the bill? What should I be getting tickets to this year?
Yeah, so the three main headliners this year are All Them Witches, Flyanna Boss, and Devotchka. Devotchka is currently having a moment with their music from the film Little Miss Sunshine trending online recently, and they played the first ever iteration of UMS.
cool. So they're having kind of a full circle moment.
Absolutely.
And is this your first time attending UMass?
This will be, and I'm very excited.
Very, very cool. It's a fun festival, but definitely be sure to hydrate, because I've seen many of people pass out along the pavements of South Broadway. People forget how hot it is out there. Now, on the complete other end of summer spectrum, there is something completely different happening at the end of July, the Mile Long Table. You're also covering this event for us, so can you tell us a little bit about why this isn't your average potluck, Sadie?
Yeah, so Mile Long Table is happening on July 26th. That's a Saturday at 10 a.m. on the Auraria campus, and it will be a mile-long table where 5,280 people will sit together and be able to connect and eat food and just spend the day together. Registration closes on July 19th if you are interested in attending that event. They really encourage you to sit with different people that you may not know. You can buy group tickets, but is really recommending to talk with some strangers, get to know people who are around in the community.
So better get your seats fast before that table fills up. Thanks so much for that report, Sadie.
Thank you.
For our final segment this month, we're turning to one of Denver's most beloved heartbreakers, the Colorado Rockies. If you've read Ryland's recent piece for Bucket List, you know it's more than a recap. It's a reckoning for him. Thank you for joining me, Ryland, to talk a little bit more about the Rockies.
And thank you.
So tell me, what really is wrong with them?
That's a very complicated question, because there's not just one answer. There's a lot of organizational incompetence going on when you're on pace to be the worst team in Major League Baseball history, and that's no small feat. There's many things that are broken, and it really just starts with Dick Monfort, the Rockies owner, and decisions made from the ownership group.
And I know this must be hard for you to say, because from reading your piece, you have a deep love of both baseball and the Rockies.
I do. I grew up a huge baseball fan. I grew up around the game. I loved it until a couple of years ago, and I just can't. I can't do it anymore. I can't pay any attention or give it any time or money. It's not worth it anymore.
What would you say that breaking point was for you with the team?
I would definitely say the Nolan Arenado trade is what sent me on the downfall. Not only are you giving likely the best and most talented player that this franchise has ever seen away, but you're giving him away plus $50 million to just take him. That really stung, and that really lost my trust and faith in the ownership group, and it's been downhill from there.
Yeah, you know, one thing that always surprises me about the team is they're so historically bad. Everybody knows that, and yet Coors Field is always full. How do you explain that?
What I think it really comes down to is that Denver loves baseball. Denver and baseball really go hand in hand. You can go back to the days of the Denver Bears, but people here love baseball, and they love to go spend an afternoon in the sun at the ballpark, drinking a beer, having a good time. And I think at times the experience of being at the ballpark can trump actually your care to watch good baseball. And people still show up and spend their money, and the ownership group is still making money, so they're prioritizing their bottom line instead of giving the fans a good product on the field.
So what needs to change with the Rockies in order for them to win you back?
First and foremost, they need to field a competitive roster. I have not seen them field a competitive roster since 2018. We're getting pretty close to a decade, and it's not like Dick Monfort and the ownership group can't afford to do that. You know, this is a very wealthy person and a wealthy organization. They can afford to go and make big splashes, get big names. They need to show me that they care about winning.
Yeah, so the ownership has just gotten complacent. They know that people are going to show up, so they're not really even trying anymore.
Totally, yeah. They know people are going to show up, and they're going to spend their money. So why would they field an expensive roster when they could field a cheap roster and make more money?
Well said. Thanks for that update on the Rockies, Ryland.
Thanks for having me.
That wraps up the very first episode of Bucket List Community Cafe's radio show here on KGNU. We'll be back on the first Thursday of every month. Our next episode drops August 7th, so mark your calendars. If you want to know more about Bucket List, please go to our website at bucketlistcommunitycafe.com and subscribe to receive our free newsletters. A big thanks to our reporting team, Sadie Gonzalez, PJ Guidry, and Ryland Scholes, as well as everyone else who helped bring this episode to life. including music from DJ Chris Nathan. If you like what we're doing online and on air, please contribute at bucketlistcommunitycafe.com. Until next time, I'm Tony Tresca, and this has been Bucket List on KGNU. Stay curious, stay connected, and keep showing up for your neighbors.
Support comes from Boulder Weekly, an independently owned newspaper available at area newsstands, outdoor boxes, and online at boulderweekly.com.
Support from the production of Economic Update comes in part from Democracy at Work, a nonprofit 501c3 organization and publisher of books by Richard Wolff, who is a professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst and a visiting professor at the New School University, has authored numerous books on the subject of social economics, including Rethinking Marxism, Understanding Capitalism, and Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Further information is available at democracyatwork.info and rdwolff.com.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to begin by thanking Charlie Fabian and all of you who have sent in materials for Charlie to work up and to help us plan our programs. You can and please do continue to send us what you have, charlie.info438@gmail.com. Today is going to be a special program. We're not going to have short segments. We're not going to have a guest to interview. Instead, I've prepared a presentation that responds to something many of you have asked me to do, plus something which the literature exploding all around us, articles, books, newspaper stories, videos, obviously show an interest. It has to do with whether the category of fascism applies to what is going on in the United States today. On the 14th of June,